The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
That's interesting to hear that the Irish Greyhound Board has decided to introduce a confidential telephone line where people can alert it to mistreatment of animals, because that's where we're going to start the week trending with Roe McDermott, a hot press journalist, and Damien McLaughlin, Professor of Marketing at UCD Smurfit Business School. Because one of the stories, Roe, that we had is in relation to another major investigation into animal cruelty, this time involving 35 thoroughbred horses. We seem to get so many stories of maltreatment of animals for a country which loves priding itself on how much we love our horses and dogs and cats.
Yeah, it's getting very scary. So these 35 thoroughbred horses were seized last month, and it was in Enniscorthy in County Wexford, and they were found in a very bad state and emaciated from malnourishment and neglect, and they're now being cared for by the Irish Horse Welfare Trust. But it's understood that this inquiry is kind of connected with a number of separate fraud of investigations that are linked to the horse breeding sector. So I think it is getting incredibly scary, and I think that documentary about greyhound racing also highlights the danger of animal sports and people involved in animal sports, whether to do with the animals or to do with the money around it, not living up to their side of a contract with the public and not looking out for the welfare of these animals. And I think these investigations
are really
showing the abuses.
There are lots of people who do very much care for their animals.
Absolutely.
And love their animals. And those involved, even in from a business professional point of view, if they are breeding them for sport and the rest of it. But it's shocking as well, on the other hand. I mean, the overbreeding of greyhounds, the overbreeding of dogs, the horrible conditions for export. Even this week, there was this case, I think it was in Dublin Port, where dogs were found and the puppies were simply too young to have been separated from their mother. Mm. They were that young that they've been taken away.
Yeah, and this happens like around the world. I think another horse has died at Santa Anita Park in California, which is the 27th horse to be euthanized since the racing season started last December. So this happens all over the place. And of course, there are people who take great care of the animals. But I think it just points to there needs to be a proper systemic regulatory sense of vigilance and investigating where large numbers of animals are being kept, who's in control of them, and why they're being kept. Because there was also implications that some business people were claiming that land was being used for horse breeding and having horses there but not taking care of them, but it was to do with the land and the money.
I think the difficulty with this, I mean, this case is clearly one of a financial fraud, Matt. The guards are involved. The investigation was not of animal welfare, it was of a financial fraud, which seems to have an international dimension. I think the real problem with these kinds of stories, and the greyhound story as well, is this, that as Ireland moves further and further from the land, we always said people were two generations from land. I suspect it might be three or four now, that you read these kinds of terrible stories and you assume that everybody who keeps horses or everybody who keeps dogs or anybody who raises puppies as part of their income is a bad person in some way. So I think this is very damaging. And it seems to me that farmers and rural life has been pushed out on a limb in Ireland again in the last 6 months. And I think these stories contribute to it. People are doing bad things towards animals.
I'll tell you about the bad things. Even a decade ago when the property crash happened, the amount of horses that were simply abandoned was actually extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the knacker's yards where how horses were euthanized could not even keep up with the amount of horses that were there. So it's an indulgence perhaps to hard of people that they keep animals when they're flush with cash. But when the cash runs out, suddenly the animals are just disposable.
Well, the thing to remember, though, is that, Matt, that millions of people in this country have made their living from animals for a very long time. Welfare has not been an issue for the 99.99999%
of those
people.
I'm not sure you can go that big a number, 99.99%.
I'd go 99.9 then,
there's,
Matt.
There's far too many examples of neglect and cruelty to animals. There are far too many, for example, puppy farms. These are illegal businesses, illicit businesses, been run around the country and smuggling going out to say that that everybody in the industry is actually doing the right thing.
Puppy farms, I have no expertise in that, but I have been to beef abattoirs where there is a stereotypical farmer calming the animals before they go to slaughter, because it's nice for the animals, it's better for the meat as well. It's for a commercial reason. Those people actually care about what happens to the animals and what happens at the end of their lives. So I think if you looked at the total capacity, I think it's a 99.9. We could argue about the decimal places, but I think
definitely
it's isolated cases. It's very, very isolated cases.
Well, I think
across
there's a huge difference between animals being neglected because the people owning them suddenly have taken a hit in terms of their finances and are able to care for them in the exact same way, because horses in particular are expensive. massive animal to take care of. So there's a huge difference between that form of neglect, which is deeply unfortunate, and then intentional neglect, like it seems to be the case in this fraud case. But I think that's the thing. If there are more regulation and more kind of welfare checks on animals, I think genuine people who care for animals, genuinely want to take care of them, would welcome that, because then it would open up avenues to support if people are taking a financial hit and they thought that the welfare of their animals was going to be affected, they could reach
out. And a need for urban elites such as I am, at least, to appreciate how country life actually happens. And I don't mean people who live in non-Dublin cities. I mean people who actually live in the countryside.
But Damien, there's another story. We mentioned it on the business news the other night. And this was an interesting one in the courts this week, where permission for the construction of about 200 homes, nearly all apartments, but a number of houses as well, on Cross Avenue in Blackrock has been denied because the plans submitted failed to take into account the environmental protection of bats. What do you make of that?
It's an interesting kind of story, Matt. One of the big and well-known developers, apparently...
Cairn Homes.
Put on the website of the Bord Pinola website the wrong documentation, which didn't say how they were going to care for these bats. And the local residents association, I don't have the name of the residents association, used that as a basis to object to the development of the land. I thought actually two things about it. One was, isn't it great that somebody in the High Court or somebody is actually paying very close attention to what developers are doing this time around? In a sense that it seems like the last time we had this building boom, and we do have a housing building boom, particularly in Dublin right now.
Well, it's not a boom. We're trying to catch up with the lack of supply.
Well, I mean, some economists, Matt, are saying the housing crisis is over. Incomes are rising and supply is rising. So everything is on the right kind of road. I might have to say I'm of that view. House prices seem to be settling, if not declining.
About 13,000 houses per annum fewer than we actually require.
Well, here's the interesting thing I think about that, Madam. I mean, in shows like this, during the crisis, the construction industry was telling us that we were going to be short of houses, given the demographics of the country. You can't argue with demographics. We did nothing about it. Now we're catching up. But I think the key thing here is I like the idea of the High Court keeping developers seriously in line. What I don't like the idea of is it seems like this is a well-resourced South County Dublin Residents Association who has the resources to go to the High Court against a developer and stop him
technicality. They care deeply about the bats.
I'm sure they do care about rats with wings very deeply.
But as it happens, Rob, when we discussed this with myself and Ian Guider the other night, the enormous amount of text messages I got and were very taken aback by people who were saying, hold on a second, there are specific habitat rules in place that the European Union have for very good reason, that we need to protect the environment, we need to protect species like bats, even if we don't like them.
I agree, and I think that's what's interesting about this story, because I think it's very easy to read a headline about this and get outraged and say, oh, we care about bats more than we care about housing people. But I think the thing is, like, this development may well continue and go on eventually once paperwork is sorted out, once the official documents are submitted. But I think the issue is that it's about accountability. It's also about research data. Like, when you take on a project like this and you interrupt and kind of disrupt the flora and fauna of the area, even having that data on hand is very useful for environmental impact reports, for analysing the effect of urban development on animals, on the environment. And so that mightn't be a huge issue for the bats in this case, but eventually for different projects that will come together. So research data is incredibly important. I also think this story can be a great distraction from the larger issue that is affecting housing in terms of prices, in terms of businesses being prioritised, in terms of services not extending outwards from Dublin, that makes it very difficult for people to move outside and retain the same access to services. So I think this week probably Owen Murphy and Leo Varadkar are loving bats more than any other animal, because it's getting people off their back and blaming the bats instead of
them. They seem to be getting lucky with a lot of things like that at the moment, don't they?
Now, Ro, tell us about Instagram's decision to warn users that they're about to post something mean.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. This is being introduced as the British government is developing more regulations to tackle social media platforms and make them responsible for harmful material which they allow users to share and discover. So Instagram is introducing a new feature which will automatically challenge users before they post something if the language used might be offensive or if it seems like it's having a bullying tone. So it'll literally say, this post seems like it might be harmful.
Artificial intelligence will be able to tell.
I think it's basically, I think the general idea is that when you make a spelling mistake, it'll be auto-corrected. But basically the words are monitored, so they have a list of words that seem like they may be insulting. So it'll be a literal check going, are you sure you want to post this? Which I think is a really interesting idea, because I think as most people who've used social media have seen, there's a lot of bullying, there's a lot of really nasty interactions happening, and it's becoming more and more normalised and more casual.
It's a good reminder also to people that Facebook, who owns Instagram, is reading all your messages before you go out there and deciding whether they like the message or not. I'm a bit cynical about this one, I have to say, because basically it gives Facebook stroke Instagram a legal protection in court that if in the event somebody says to a person, you know, to go and do something, you know, maybe to something that was negative for them, and the person does it, they have no legal liability then because they have warned the person about the content.
Yeah, but should they try and escape legal liability? But they do, technically, they should, as publishers. They're just trying to exploit loopholes in the law, not to take
responsibility. I think we need more robust legislation to rein in the so-called social media giants. They basically are running ahead of legislation at the moment. We don't really know what to do with them. And this is a tokenism on their part, I think, to save themselves from legal action.
But I think it's interesting because I think we need to look at the balance of responsibility of these huge platforms and the users. And I think what I like about this idea is that it puts the responsibility back on the user to say, like, no, you were literally warned. You were given a moment to consider whether you wanted to post something offensive and you still chose to. So it isn't the excuse of, oh, I was just hyped up. I was just having an interaction.
That assumes on the part that every person, and there's a case for this, every person in school would have to be provided with media literacy. That is, they would understand if you put a message out there that it's there forever, that it could be communicated to anybody and the other person could take it literally. And I think that's too much to ask. It's too much to ask anybody, but it's too much to ask a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old or even an older person. I don't think it is the responsibility of the citizen to be sufficiently media literate to act appropriately in this.
But media literacy and communication literacy and empathy literacy are increasingly getting intertwined, and I think there is an idea of personal responsibility there that people need to start saying, this is actually a real person that you're sending this message to, and just because you're typing on Instagram doesn't mean you're not saying this. Like, it is like saying it to somebody, and almost worse because people get inundated with messages in a way they mightn't in real life.
Damien, what's this trend now for parents buying so-called dumb phones?
Oh, it seems, Matt, that parents have started to buy their children what were the leading edge technology phones from a few years ago, the old Nokia, very small block phones that play Snake and so on, the ones we enjoyed first time around. And they buy them for their kids as starter phones so that they can contact them, they can contact their parents. But it doesn't have all of the features.
This is not new. I tried that 5 years ago with one of my children. When she was demanding a phone, and I presented her with a fantastic 6310, which I just happened to have in its box. I don't know how I'd had it. It still worked perfectly. Put a SIM card in for her. She refused to use it. Matt, she just wanted the same type of phone that all her friends wanted.
Okay, but what happened then? If she refused to use it, did you just give her a smartphone?
No, not immediately, but over time.
A week later, Matt.
Months later.
What's wrong with saying no? Why can't parents just say no?
I did say no, and I gave her that instead.
But why don't you just continue? I don't know why parents can just say, no, you cannot have a smartphone. No, you cannot be on Facebook. You should not be on these things until you're 16. You need to have a certain level of literacy, right? I don't see what the problem is. I don't know why we have to fold when you get into sixth class or you make your confirmation, whatever stage of life ceremony.
Fair play, done if you can get to sixth class and confirmation.
There you go. Just say no. What's the problem?
I think this is a very good compromise for parents because, of course, a lot of parents like the idea of their kids having mobile phones so they can contact them in an emergency. They can keep them updated on where they are. If they're out with their friends, they can call them. But again, all these conversations that we're having about young kids and even young teenagers having access to the internet, unbridled access to everything the internet has to offer, the good, the bad, and often the terrifying. And I think this is a really good solution. And I also think it's an interesting way to introduce slowly the idea of media literacy, the idea of technology literacy, and the idea of responsibility of saying you're allowed access to some things, but you're only allowed to have access to the internet when you're at home, when I can supervise, if it's on the family computer in the living room. And it's a way of introducing these ideas slowly and having ongoing conversations, because I think that's something that I frequently encounter in my work, is parents being very concerned about their kids' access to pornography or explicit material, very adult material. And my constant response is, you can't react to these issues with the conversation. You have to be proactive and have them in an ongoing way. And before you give them access, you have to teach them and let them know what they might encounter. Let them know that they can always ask you questions.
It's too much of an ask, I think, of parents to have that level of education. I think just think about what is actually required in that situation. You would have to sit down with a child over an extended period of time after the maths homework, after the Irish homework, after you get in from work, after
you cook dinner, after you do a shaking.
Well, you take them for a walk with the dog. The best way of speaking to a child, quite serious, rather than looking at them face on across the table, is to take them out for a walk with a dog and chat through these whole things as you go for the walk.
I think it is too much to ask the population as a whole to engage in that kind of activity, Matt. To expect change to happen as a result of parents bringing their kids out for a walk with the dog and it's sufficiently quiet that you can have that. I actually think it's too much to ask. If you want societal change, it's too much to ask.
But then I frequently get questions saying, oh, my kids have had access to the internet and I'm really concerned, or I found out that they've been looking at inappropriate material and now what do I do? And the response there is like they're looking to experts, they're looking to teachers who haven't been trained to have these conversations. They're complaining because costs of therapy are high.
Often get very annoyed about the fact that they're required, they're kept in
last
to do things that should be done
by
the parents at home.
And a lot of people can't afford then to have conversations with, say, professional therapists and send their kids to them to have those important conversations. So we have to be willing to take some responsibility. And I think the idea of a dumb phone is interesting because it also gives parents a learning curve and gives them a bit of advance warning of going, okay, if we introduce WhatsApp on the phone, or if we give them access to the internet, what are the conversations we need to have at this stage? And it lets parents prep instead of giving them a smartphone to go and I need to address everything.
It's too much to ask.
Once.
And I think even the parental literacy of parents today, I certainly find even my own kids, I'd rather be friends with my kids almost than be that authoritarian figure. And I think that's the case for a lot of parents with kids.
Okay, tell us about the e-scooters in Copenhagen.
Oh, Matt. Oh, my God. I mean, e-scooter. So basically, the Danish police have locked up I don't know if they've locked them up or not, but I hope they've locked them up.
They've arrested and charged.
They've arrested and charged 28 of these guys who work for social media firms. You know the kind of guys, Matt, they have the beards and the skinny jeans. They're all like...
You sound envious, Damien.
Matt, you have no idea how envious, but they're scooting along at 20 kilometres an hour with their earphones in, oblivious to everybody. They've, of course, got their what do you call those dogs? The healthy mind dogs. You know those things? What do you call them?
Support dogs?
They've got their support dog on under one arm as they go down to Canal Street, and then they've got their lunchbox with their quinoa in it under their other arm, and they're scooting down the road, Matt. They pay no tax. They have no insurance. They pay no regard to anybody else. And can I make a sense? I'm actually serious about that. Is the profile you never see a sensible woman doing it? Sometimes they're on the path, sometimes they're in the cycle lane, sometimes they're on the road. But here's the thing, Matt. If you ever wonder, this is a cynical play as well. I think that the reason why cyclists who are very aggressive on the roads. Now I appreciate that drivers are also very aggressive.
You mentioned cyclists. The texts are going.
Let me finish the point now. Let me finish it. In Berlin, I spent a lot of time in Berlin. In Berlin, the city is owned by cyclists. It's terrific. But cyclists there are very aggressive. And the reason why they get away with it, and the reason why cyclists are so powerful in this city, is because they have scale. There are so many of them now. They've got together as a lobby group. It's very difficult to do anything about them. We need to stop e-scooters in this city before they get scale.
Hang on, this is a story about people who've been drunk and under the influence of drugs. There's a big difference.
I think at least those people had an excuse for their appalling behaviour. I think I've never seen anybody on an e-scooter who behaved in an appropriate fashion. And there are no benefits from e-scooters. I mean, scooting itself, I could see there might be a health benefit to it. But I cannot see a single benefit to allowing e-scooters on pathways, road.
Well, for people who have quite a short commute.
They can walk.
But if your commute is short, okay, where you live in Ireland, by the way, but like if your commute is short enough that, or if it's awkward enough that taking public transport isn't an option,
cycle.
And you would otherwise
you
take a
cycle.
Car, perhaps they don't want to. Perhaps they have
so
mobility
instead,
issues that make
instead
scooter
they get
easier.
These bloody e-scooters that knock into people and bang off cars, and that they can carry their dog
has
on.
Has somebody banged into your car?
Is that where the aggression is coming from?
I have to say no, Matt. I actually think we have this idea now, and it's particularly prevalent. You know, if you're out of Ireland for a while and you come back, one of the things that I notice, at least, there's a level of aggression of people on the roads here. It's not like that in every country.
I hope they're not saying the cyclists are worse than the drivers.
I don't think aggression can be measured in the same way as cyclists and drivers, because drivers are literally in a car that could kill you. So if cyclists react, they're reacting to literally the threat of being knocked by a car.
I'm applying it to all. I mean, I think drivers are terribly aggressive towards each other and towards cyclists. And the cyclists are equally as aggressive.
You can't be equally aggressive if someone has a lethal vehicle and you're on a bike. Aggression cannot be measured equally.
It is the intent of aggression which is equal. And I think cyclists have decided that they are entitled, because they're cyclists and because they're
vulnerable, to swear at the same volume as people.
They're entitled to swear at people. They're entitled to pull in front. They're entitled not to observe traffic signals and the normal rules of the road. They have no insurance. They pay no tax. And they think they're entitled to do whatever they wish. But there's nothing we can do about it, because they're a critical mass now.
Okay,
and a pressure
David,
group.
Let Ro respond, please, on behalf of the cyclists of Ireland.
You're not a cyclist, Ro, are you?
I'm not even a cyclist, but I think it's incredibly important to have respect for cyclists and for even these scooters. But I think the issue is that a lot of people have been drunk on the scooters, and that becomes incredibly dangerous, because even if scooters are using like bike lanes instead of the paths, if you're drunk and on a scooter and you veer into the road, then you're causing a driver to veer, and there can be huge knock-on effects. So I absolutely think if you're using them, one of these legislation has to be brought in that it's the same in terms of like drink driving, driving under the influence, operating this vehicle. Because if you're on the road, then you can impact drivers. And drivers are, of course, going to cause the most dangerous accidents. Well, so
I'm sure in the pubs down around the canal, the Grand Canal area down there, I'm sure the idea of being drunk on a scooter is a very funny story to tell. Whereas the same people would not tell the same story about drink driving. There's a level of irresponsibility,
Damien,
with scooters.
As a listener from the Dublin Cycling Campaign says, oh, couldn't help but notice that your male guest cut off your female guest multiple times during the discussion before he accused cyclists of being really aggressive.
Okay, have you texted him when we weren't talking about cycling, though? I mean, don't use feminism to defend me for you. Thank you very much.
Ro, I do apologise if I did do that, but you should have listened to us during the break where we had a very robust discussion, which I came off the worse of.
We have to go. Thank
Looking
you very
forward
much.
To that cyclist defending me on all of my platforms. Thank you very much.
Ro McDermott from Hot Press in the Irish Times and Damien McLaughlin from the Swerfield Business School. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.